father away from his own country. Later it would be learned that the idea that was working on him at the time was the unification of the Federalist forces of Central America in order to wipe out conservative regimes from Alaska to Patagonia. The first direct news that Ursula received from him, several years after his departure, was a wrinkled and faded letter that had arrived, passing through various hands, from Santiago, Cuba. "We've lost him forever," Ursula exclaimed on reading it. "If he follows this path, he'll spend Christmas at the ends of the earth." The person to whom she said it, who was the first to whom she showed the letter, was the conservative general José Raquel Moncada, mayor of Macondo since the end of the war. "This Aureliano," General Moncada commented, "what a pity that he's not a conservative." He really admired him. Like many conservative civilians, José Raquel Moncada had waged war in defense of his party and had earned the title of general on the field of battle, even though he was not a military man by profession. On the contrary, like so many of his fellow party members, he was an anti-militarist. He considered military men unprincipled loafers, ambitious plotters, experts in facing down civilians in order to prosper during times of disorder. Intelligent, pleasant, ruddy-faced, a man who liked to eat and watch cockfights, he had been at one time the most feared adversary of Colonel Aureliano Buendia. He succeeded in imposing his authority over the career officers in a wide sector along the coast. One time, when he was forced by strategic circumstances to abandon a stronghold to the forces of Colonel Aureliano Buendia, he left two letters for him. In one of them, quite long, he invited him to join in a campaign to make the war more humane. The other letter was for his wife, who lived in liberal territory, and he left it with a plea to see that it reached its destination. From then on, even in the bloodiest periods of the war, the two commanders would arrange truces to exchange prisoners. They were pauses with a certain festive atmosphere, which General Moncada took advantage of to teach Colonel Aureliano Buendia how to play chess. They became great friends. They even came to think about the possibility of coordinating the popular elements of both parties, doing away with the influence of the military men and professional politicians, and setting up a humanitarian regime that would take the best from each doctrine. When the war was over, while Colonel Aureliano Buendia was sneaking about through the narrow trails of permanent subversion, General Moncada was named Magistrate of Macondo. He wore civilian clothes, replaced the soldiers with unarmed policemen, enforced the amnesty laws, and helped the few families of liberals who had been killed in the war. He succeeded in having Macondo raised to the status of a municipality, and he was therefore its first mayor, and he created an atmosphere of confidence that made people think of the war as an absurd nightmare of the past. Father Nicanor, consumed by hepatic fever, was replaced by Father Coronel, whom they called the Pup, a veteran of the First Federalist War. Bruno Crespi, who was married to Amparo Moscote, and whose shop of toys and musical instruments continued to prosper, built a theatre which Spanish companies included in their itineraries. It was a vast open-air hall with wooden benches, a velvet curtain with Greek masks, and three box offices in the shape of lions' heads, through whose mouths the tickets were sold. It was also about that time that the school was rebuilt. It was put under the charge of Don Melchor Escalona, an old teacher brought from the swamp, who made his lazy students walk on their knees in the lime-coated courtyard and made the students who talked in class eat hot chili, with the approval of their parents. Aureliano II and José Arcadio II, the willful twins of Santa Sofia de la Piedad, were the first to sit in the classroom, with their slates, their chalk, and their aluminum jugs with their names on them. Remedios, who inherited her mother's pure beauty, began to be known as Remedios the Beauty. In spite of time, of the superimposed periods of mourning, and her accumulated afflictions, Ursula resisted growing old. Aided by Santa Sofia de la Piedad, she gave a new drive to her pastry business, and in a few years not only recovered the fortune that her son had spent in the war, but she once more stuffed with pure gold the gourds buried in the bedroom. "As long as God gives me life," she would say, "there will always be money in this madhouse." That was how things were when Aureliano José deserted the federal troops in Nicaragua, signed on as a crewman on a German ship, and appeared in the kitchen of the house, sturdy as a horse, as dark and long-haired as an Indian, and with a secret determination to marry Amaranta. When Amaranta saw him come in, even though he said nothing, she knew immediately why he had come back. At the table they did not dare look each other in the face. But 2 weeks after his return, in the presence of Ursula, he set his eyes on hers and said to her, "I always thought a lot about you." Amaranta avoided him. She guarded against chance meetings. She tried not to become separated from Remedios the Beauty. She was ashamed of the blush that covered her cheeks on the day her nephew asked her how long she intended wearing the black bandage on her hand, for she interpreted it as an allusion to her virginity. When he arrived, she barred the door of her bedroom, but she heard his peaceful snoring in the next room for so many nights that she forgot about the precaution. Early one morning, almost 2 months after his return, she heard him come into the bedroom. Then, instead of fleeing, instead of shouting as she had thought she would, she let herself be saturated with a soft feeling of relaxation. She felt him slip in under the mosquito netting as he had done when he was a child, as he had always done, and she could not repress her cold sweat and the chattering of her teeth when she realized that he was completely naked.
"Go away,"
she whispered, suffocating with curiosity.
"Go away or I'll scream."
But Aureliano Jose knew then what he had to do, because he was no longer a child but a barracks animal. Starting with that night, the dull, inconsequential battles began again, and would go on until dawn.
"I'm your aunt,"
Amaranta murmured, spent.
"It's almost as if I were your mother, not just because of my age, but because the only thing I didn't do for you was nurse you."
Aureliano would escape at dawn and come back early in the morning on the next day, each time more excited by the proof that she had not barred the door. He had not stopped desiring her for a single instant. He found her in the dark bedrooms of captured towns, especially in the most abject ones, and he would make her materialize in the smell of dry blood on the bandages of the wounded, in the instantaneous terror of the danger of death, at all times and in all places. He had fled from her in an attempt to wipe out her memory, not only through distance, but by means of a muddled fury that his companions at arms took to be boldness. But the more her image wallowed in the dunghill of the war, the more the war resembled Amaranta. That was how he suffered in exile, looking for a way of killing her with his own death, until he heard some old man tell the tale of the man who had married his aunt, who was also his cousin, and whose son ended up being his own grandfather.
"Can a person marry his own aunt?" he asked, startled.
"He not only can do that," a soldier answered him, "but we're fighting this war against the priests so that a person can marry his own mother."
2 weeks later, he deserted. He found Amaranta more withered than in his memory, more melancholy and shy, and now really turning the last corner of maturity, but more feverish than ever in the darkness of her bedroom, and more challenging than ever in the aggressiveness of her resistance.
"You're a brute,"
Amaranta would tell him as she was harried by his hounds.
"You can't do that to a poor aunt unless you have a special dispensation from the Pope."
Aureliano Jose promised to go to Rome. He promised to go across Europe on his knees to kiss the sandals of the pontiff, just so that she would lower her drawbridge.
"It's not just that,"
Amaranta retorted. "Any children will be born with the tail of a pig." Aureliano Jose was deaf to all arguments.
"I don't care if they're born as armadillos," he begged.
Early one morning, vanquished by the unbearable pain of repressed virility, he went to Caterino's. He found a woman with flaccid breasts, affectionate and cheap, who calmed his stomach for some time. He tried to apply the treatment of disdain to Amaranta. He would see her on the porch working at the sewing machine, which she had learned to operate with admirable skill, and he would not even speak to her. Amaranta felt freed of a reef, and she herself did not understand why she started thinking again at that time about Colonel Gerineldo Marquez, why she remembered with such nostalgia the afternoons of Chinese checkers, and why she even desired him as the man in her bedroom. Aureliano Jose did not realize how much ground he had lost on the night he could no longer bear the farce of indifference and went back to Amaranta's room. She rejected him with an inflexible and unmistakable determination, and she barred the door of her bedroom forever.
A few months after the return of Aureliano José, an exuberant woman perfumed with jasmine appeared at the house with a boy of 5. She stated that he was the son of Colonel Aureliano Buendía, and that she had brought him to Ursula to be baptized. No one doubted the origins of that nameless child. He looked exactly like the colonel at the time he was taken to see ICE for the first time. The woman said that he had been born with his eyes open, looking at people with the judgment of an adult, and that she was frightened by his way of staring at things without blinking.
"He's identical," Ursula said. "The only thing missing is for him to make chairs rock by simply looking at them."
They christened him Aureliano, and with his mother's last name, since the law did not permit a person to bear his father's name until he had recognized him. General Moncada was the godfather. Although Amaranta insisted that he be left so that she could take over his upbringing, his mother was against it. Ursula, at that time, did not know about the custom of sending virgins to the bedrooms of soldiers, in the same way that hens are turned loose with fine roosters, but in the course of that year she found out. 9 more sons of Colonel Aureliano Buendía were brought to the house to be baptized. The oldest, a strange dark boy with green eyes, who was not at all like his father's family, was over 10 years old. They brought children of all ages, all colors, but all males, and all with a look of solitude that left no doubt as to the relationship. Only 2 stood out in the group. 1, large for his age, made smithereens out of the flower pots and china because his hand seemed to have the property of breaking everything they touched. The other was a blonde boy with the same light eyes as his mother, whose hair had been left to grow long and curly like that of a woman. He entered the house with a great deal of familiarity, as if he had been raised there, and he went directly to a chest in Ursula's bedroom and demanded, "I want the mechanical ballerina." Ursula was startled. She opened the chest, searched among the ancient and dusty articles left from the days of Melchiades, and wrapped in a pair of stockings she found the mechanical ballerina that Pietro Crespi had brought to the house once, and that everyone had forgotten about. In less than 12 years they baptized, with the name Aureliano and the last name of the mother, all the sons that the colonel had implanted up and down his theatre of war. 17. At first, Ursula would fill their pockets with money, and Amaranta tried to have them stay, but they finally limited themselves to giving them presents and serving as godmothers. "We've done our duty by baptizing them," Ursula would say, jotting down in a ledger the name and address of the mother and the place and date of birth of the child. "Aureliano needs well-kept accounts so that he can decide things when he comes back." During lunch, commenting with General Moncada about that disconcerting proliferation, she expressed the desire for Colonel Aureliano Buendía to come back some day and gather all of his sons together in the house. "Don't worry, dear friend," General Moncada said enigmatically. "He'll come sooner than you suspect." What General Moncada knew, and what he did not wish to reveal at lunch, was that Colonel Aureliano Buendía was already on his way to head up the most prolonged, radical, and bloody rebellion of all those he had started up till then. The situation again became as tense as it had been during the months that preceded the first war. The cockfights, instituted by the mayor himself, were suspended. Captain Aquiles Ricardo, the commander of the garrison, took over the exercise of municipal power. The liberals looked upon him as a provocateur. "Something terrible is going to happen," Ursula would say to Aureliano José. "Don't go out into the street after 6 o'clock." The entreaties were useless. Aureliano José, just like Arcadio in other times, had ceased to belong to her. It was as if his return home, the possibility of existing without concerning himself with everyday necessities, had awakened in him the lewd and lazy leanings of his uncle José Arcadio. His passion for Amaranta had been extinguished without leaving any scars. He would drift around, playing pool, easing his solitude with occasional women, sacking the hiding places where Ursula had forgotten her money. He ended up coming home only to change his clothes.
"They're all alike," Ursula lamented. "At first they behave very well. They're obedient and prompt, and they don't seem capable of killing a fly. But as soon as their beards appear, they go to ruin."
Unlike Arcadio, who had never known his real origins, he found out that he was the son of Pilar Tenera, who had hung up a hammock so that he could take his siesta in her house. More than mother and son, they were accomplices in solitude.
Pilar Tenera had lost the trail of all hope. Her laugh had taken on the tones of an organ, her breasts had succumbed to the tedium of endless caressing, her stomach and her thighs had been the victims of her irrevocable fate as a shared woman. But her heart grew old with bitterness. Fat, talkative, with the airs of a matron in disgrace, she renounced the sterile illusions of her cards and found peace and consolation in other people's loves. In the house where Aureliano José took his siesta, the girls from the neighborhood would receive their casual lovers.
"Lend me your room, Pilar,"
they would simply say when they were already inside.
"Of course,"
Pilar would answer, and if anyone was present she would explain,
"I'm happy knowing that people are happy in bed."
She never charged for the service. She never refused the favor, just as she never refused the countless men who sought her out, even in the twilight of her maturity, without giving her money or love, and only occasionally pleasure. Her five daughters, who inherited a burning seed, had been lost on the byways of life since adolescence. Of the two sons she managed to raise, one died fighting in the forces of Colonel Aureliano Buendía, and the other was wounded and captured at the age of 14, when he tried to steal a crate of chickens in a town in the swamp. In a certain way, Aureliano José was the tall, dark man who had been promised her for half a century by the King of Hearts, and like all men sent by the cards, he reached her heart when he was already stamped with the mark of death. She saw it in the cards.
"Don't go out tonight," she told him. "Stay and sleep here, because Carmelita Montiel is getting tired of asking me to put her in your room."
Aureliano José did not catch the deep feeling of begging that was in the offer.
"Tell her to wait for me at midnight," he said.
He went to the theater, where a Spanish company was putting on The Dagger of the Fox, which was really Zoria's play, with the title changed by order of Captain Aquiles Ricardo, because the liberals called the conservatives goths. Only when he handed in his ticket at the door did Aureliano José realize that Captain Aquiles Ricardo and two soldiers armed with rifles were searching the audience.
"Be careful, Captain,"
Aureliano José warned him. "The man hasn't been born yet who can lay hands on me." The captain tried to search him forcibly, and Aureliano José, who was unarmed, began to run. The soldiers disobeyed the order to shoot.
"He's a Buendía,"
one of them explained. Blind with rage, the captain then snatched away the rifle, stepped into the center of the street, and took aim.
"Cowards," he shouted. "I only wish it was Colonel Aureliano Buendía."
Carmelita Montiel, a 20-year-old virgin, had just bathed in orange blossom water and was strewing rosemary leaves on Pilar Tenera's bed when the shot rang out. Aureliano José had been destined to find with her the happiness that Amaranta had denied him, to have seven children, and to die in her arms of old age. But the bullet that entered his back and shattered his chest had been directed by a wrong interpretation of the cards. Captain Aquiles Ricardo, who was really the one destined to die that night, did indeed die, 4 hours before Aureliano José. As soon as the shot was heard, he was brought down by two simultaneous bullets, whose origin was never established, and a shout of many voices shook the night.
"Long live the Liberal Party! Long live Colonel Aureliano Buendía!"
At 12 o'clock, when Aureliano José had bled to death, and Carmelita Montiel found that the cards showing her future were blank, more than 400 men had filed past the theater and discharged their revolvers into the abandoned body of Captain Aquiles Ricardo. A patrol had to use a wheelbarrow to carry the body, which was heavy with lead and fell apart like a water-soaked loaf of bread. Annoyed by the outrages of the regular army, General José Raquel Moncada used his political influence, put on his uniform again, and assumed the civil and military leadership of Macondo. He did not expect, however, that his conciliatory attitude would be able to prevent the inevitable. The news in September was contradictory. While the government announced that it was maintaining control throughout the country, the liberals were receiving secret news of armed uprisings in the interior. The regime would not admit a state of war until it was proclaimed in a decree that had followed a court-martial, which had condemned Colonel Aureliano Buendía to death in absentia. The first unit that captured him was ordered to carry the sentence out.
This means he's come back, Ursula said joyfully to General Moncada, but he himself knew nothing about it. Actually, Colonel Aureliano Buendía had been in the country for more than a month. He was preceded by conflicting rumors, supposed to be in the most distant places at the same time, and even General Moncada did not believe in his return until it was officially announced that he had seized two states on the coast. "Congratulations, dear friend," he told Ursula, showing her the telegram. "You'll soon have him here." Ursula was worried then for the first time. "And what will you do?" she asked. General Moncada had asked himself that same question many times. "The same as he, my friend," he answered. "I'll do my duty." At dawn on the 1st of October, Colonel Aureliano Buendía attacked Macondo with 1,000 well-armed men, and the garrison received orders to resist to the end. At noon, while General Moncada was lunching with Ursula, a rebel cannon shot that echoed in the whole town blew the front of the municipal treasury to dust. "They're as well-armed as we are," General Moncada sighed, "but besides that, they're fighting because they want to." At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, while the earth trembled with the artillery fire from both sides, he took leave of Ursula with the certainty that he was fighting a losing battle. "I pray to God that you won't have Aureliano in the house tonight," he said. "If it does happen that way, give him an embrace for me, because I don't expect ever to see him again." That night he was captured when he tried to escape from Macondo after writing a long letter to Colonel Aureliano Buendía, in which he reminded him of their common aim to humanize the war, and he wished him a final victory over the corruption of the militarists and the ambitions of the politicians in both parties. On the following day, Colonel Aureliano Buendía had lunch with him in Ursula's house, where he was being held until a revolutionary court-martial decided his fate. It was a friendly gathering, but while the adversaries forgot the war to remember things of the past, Ursula had the gloomy feeling that her son was an intruder. She had felt it ever since she saw him come in, protected by a noisy military retinue, which turned the bedrooms inside out until they were convinced there was no danger. Colonel Aureliano Buendía not only accepted it, but he gave strict orders that no one should come closer than 10 feet, not even Ursula, while the members of his escort finished placing guards about the house. He was wearing an ordinary denim uniform with no insignia of any kind, and high boots with spurs that were caked with mud and dried blood. On his waist he wore a holster with the flap open, and his hand, which was always on the butt of the pistol, revealed the same watchful and resolute tension as his look. His head, with deep recessions in the hairline now, seemed to have been baked in a slow oven. His face, tanned by the salt of the Caribbean, had acquired a metallic hardness. He was preserved against imminent old age by a vitality that had something to do with the coldness of his insides. He was taller than when he had left, paler and bonier, and he showed the first symptoms of resistance to nostalgia. "Good Lord," Ursula said to herself, "now he looks like a man capable of anything." He was. The Aztec shawl that he brought Amaranta, the remembrances he spoke of at lunch, the funny stories he told, were simple leftovers from his humor of a different time. As soon as the order to bury the dead in a common grave was carried out, he assigned Colonel Roque Carnicero the mission of setting up courts-martial, and he went ahead with the exhausting task of imposing radical reforms, which would not leave a stone of the re-established conservative regime in place. "We have to get ahead of the politicians in the party," he said to his aides. "When they open their eyes to reality, they'll find accomplished facts." It was then that he decided to review the titles to land that went back 100 years, and he discovered the legalized outrages of his brother, José Arcadio. He annulled the registrations with a stroke of the pen. As a last gesture of courtesy, he left his affairs for an hour and visited Rebecca to bring her up to date on what he was determined to do. In the shadows of her house, the solitary widow, who at one time had been the confidant of his repressed loves, and whose persistence had saved his life, was a spectre out of the past. Encased in black down to her knuckles, with her heart turned to ash, she scarcely knew anything about the war. Colonel Aureliano Buendía had the impression that the phosphorescence of her bones was showing through her skin, and that she moved in an atmosphere of St. Elmo's fire, in a stagnant air where one could still note a hidden smell of gunpowder. He began by advising her to moderate the rigour of her mourning, to ventilate the house, to forgive the world for the death of José Arcadio. But Rebecca was already beyond any vanity. After searching for it uselessly in the taste of earth, in the perfumed letters from Pietro Crespi, in the tempestuous bed of her husband, she had found peace in that house where memories materialized through the strength of implacable evocation and walked like human beings through the cloistered rooms, leaning back in her wicker rocking chair, looking at Colonel Aureliano Buendia as if he were the one who looked like a ghost out of the past. Rebecca was not even upset by the news that the lands usurped by José Arcadio would be returned to their rightful owners.
"Whatever you decide will be done, Aureliano," she sighed. "I always thought, and now I have the proof, that you're a renegade."
The revision of the deeds took place at the same time as the summary courts-martial presided over by Colonel Gerineldo Marquez, which ended with the execution of all officers of the regular army who had been taken prisoner by the revolutionaries. The last court-martial was that of José Raquel Moncada. Ursula intervened.
"His government was the best we've ever had in Macondo," she told Colonel Aureliano Buendia. "I don't have to tell you anything about his good heart, about his affection for us, because you know better than anyone."
Colonel Aureliano Buendia gave her a disapproving look.
"I can't take over the job of administering justice," he replied. "If you have something to say, tell it to the court-martial."
Ursula not only did that, she also brought all of the mothers of the revolutionary officers who lived in Macondo to testify. One by one, the old women, who had been founders of the town, several of whom had taken part in the daring crossing of the mountains, praised the virtues of General Moncada. Ursula was the last in line. Her gloomy dignity, the weight of her name, the convincing vehemence of her declaration, made the scale of justice hesitate for a moment.
"You have taken this horrible game very seriously, and you have done well because you are doing your duty," she told the members of the court.
"But don't forget that as long as God gives us life, we will still be mothers, and no matter how revolutionary you may be, we have the right to pull down your pants and give you a whipping at the first sign of disrespect."
The court retired to deliberate, as those words still echoed in the school that had been turned into a barracks. At midnight, General José Raquel Moncada was sentenced to death. Colonel Aureliano Buendia, in spite of the violent recriminations of Ursula, refused to commute the sentence. A short while before dawn, he visited the condemned man in the room used as a cell.
"Remember, old friend," he told him, "I'm not shooting you. It's the revolution that's shooting you."
General Moncada did not even get up from the cot when he saw him come in.
"Go to hell, friend," he answered.
Until that moment, ever since his return, Colonel Aureliano Buendia had not given himself the opportunity to see him with his heart. He was startled to see how much he had aged, how his hands shook, and the rather punctilious conformity with which he awaited death. And then he felt a great disgust with himself, which he mingled with the beginnings of pity.
"You know better than I," he said, "that all courts-martial are farces, and that you're really paying for the crimes of other people, because this time we're going to win the war at any price. Wouldn't you have done the same in my place?"
General Moncada got up to clean his thick horn-rimmed glasses on his shirt tail.
"Probably," he said. "But what worries me is not your shooting me, because after all, for people like us, it's a natural death."
He laid his glasses on the bed and took off his watch and chain.
"What worries me," he went on, "is that out of so much hatred for the military, out of fighting them so much and thinking about them so much, you've ended up as bad as they are. And no ideal in life is worth that much baseness."
He took off his wedding ring and the Medal of the Virgin of Help and put them alongside his glasses and watch.
"At this rate," he concluded, "you'll not only be the most despotic and bloody dictator in our history, but you'll shoot my dear friend Ursula in an attempt to pacify your conscience."
Colonel Aureliano Buendia stood there impassively. General Moncada then gave him the glasses, medal, watch, and ring, and he changed his tone. "But I didn't send for you to scold you," he said. "I wanted to ask you the favor of sending these things to my wife." Colonel Aureliano Buendia put them in his pockets. "Is she still in Manare?" "She's still in Manare," General Moncada confirmed, "in the same house behind the church where you sent the letter." "I'll be glad to, Jose Racan," Colonel Aureliano Buendia said. When he went out into the blue air of the mist, his face grew damp, as on some other dawn in the past, and only then did he realize that he had ordered the sentence to be carried out in the courtyard, and not at the cemetery wall. The firing squad, drawn up opposite the door, paid him the honors of a head of state. "They can bring him out now," he ordered. Colonel Gerineldo Marquez was the first to perceive the emptiness of the war. In his position as civil and military leader of Macondo, he would have telegraphic conversations twice a week with Colonel Aureliano Buendia. At first, those exchanges would determine the course of a flesh-and-blood war, the perfectly defined outlines of which told them at any moment the exact spot where it was and the prediction of its future direction. Although he never let himself be pulled into the area of confidences, not even by his closest friends, Colonel Aureliano Buendia still had, at that time, the familiar tone that made it possible to identify him at the other end of the wire. Many times he would prolong the talks beyond the expected limit and let them drift into comments of a domestic nature. Little by little, however, and as the war became more intense and widespread, his image was fading into a universe of unreality. The characteristics of his speech were more and more uncertain, and they came together and combined to form words that were gradually losing all meaning. Colonel Gerineldo Marquez limited himself then to just listening, burdened by the impression that he was in telegraphic contact with a stranger from another world. "I understand, Aureliano," he would conclude on the key. "Long live the Liberal Party." He finally lost all contact with the war. What, in other times, had been a real activity, an irresistible passion of his youth, became a remote point of reference for him, an emptiness. His only refuge was Amaranta's sewing room. He would visit her every afternoon. He liked to watch her hands as she curled frothy petticoat cloth in the machine that was kept in motion by Remedios the Beauty. They spent many hours without speaking, content with their reciprocal company. But while Amaranta was inwardly pleased in keeping the fire of his devotion alive, he was unaware of the secret designs of that indecipherable heart. When the news of his return reached her, Amaranta had been smothered by anxiety. But when she saw him enter the house in the middle of Colonel Aureliano Buendia's noisy escort, and she saw how he had been mistreated by the rigors of exile, made old by age and oblivion, dirty with sweat and dust, smelling like a herd, ugly, with his left arm in a sling, she felt faint with disillusionment. "My God," she thought, "this wasn't the person I was waiting for." On the following day, however, he came back to the house shaved and clean, with his mustache perfumed with lavender water and without the bloody sling. He brought her a prayer book bound in mother-of-pearl. "How strange men are," she said, because she could not think of anything else to say. "They spend their lives fighting against priests and then give prayer books as gifts." From that time on, even during the most critical days of the war, he visited her every afternoon. Many times, when Remedios the Beauty was not present, it was he who turned the wheel on the sewing machine. Amaranta felt upset by the perseverance, the loyalty, the submissiveness of that man who was invested with so much authority, and who nevertheless took off his sidearms in the living room so that he could go into the sewing room without weapons. But for 4 years he kept repeating his love, and she would always find a way to reject him without hurting him, for even though she had not succeeded in loving him, she could no longer live without him. Remedios, the beauty, who seemed indifferent to everything, and who was thought to be mentally retarded, was not insensitive to so much devotion, and she intervened in Colonel Gerineldo Marquez's favor. Amaranta suddenly discovered that the girl she had raised, who was just entering adolescence, was already the most beautiful creature that had ever been seen in Macondo. She felt reborn in her heart, the rancor that she had felt in other days for Rebecca, and begging God not to impel her into the extreme state of wishing her dead, she banished her from the sewing room. It was around that time that Colonel Gerineldo Marquez began to feel the boredom of the war. He summoned his reserves of persuasion, his broad and repressed tenderness, ready to give up for Amaranta a glory that had cost him the sacrifice of his best years. But he could not succeed in convincing her. One August afternoon, overcome by the unbearable weight of her own obstinacy, Amaranta locked herself in her bedroom to weep over her solitude unto death, after giving her final answer to her tenacious suitor.
"Let's forget about each other forever," she told him. "We're too old for this sort of thing now."
Colonel Gerineldo Marquez had a telegraphic call from Colonel Aureliano Buendia that afternoon. It was a routine conversation which was not going to bring about any break in the stagnant war. At the end, Colonel Gerineldo Marquez looked at the desolate streets, the crystal water on the almond trees, and he found himself lost in solitude. "Aureliano," he said sadly on the key, "it's raining in Macondo." There was a long silence on the line. Suddenly the apparatus jumped with the pitiless letters from Colonel Aureliano Buendia. "Don't be a jackass, Gerineldo," the signal said. "It's natural for it to be raining in August." They had not seen each other for such a long time that Colonel Gerineldo Marquez was upset by the aggressiveness of the reaction. 2 months later, however, when Colonel Aureliano Buendia returned to Macondo, his upset was changed to stupefaction. Even Ursula was surprised at how much he had changed. He came with no noise, no escort, wrapped in a cloak in spite of the heat, and with three mistresses, whom he installed in the same house, where he spent most of his time lying in a hammock. He scarcely read the telegraphic dispatches that reported routine operations. On one occasion, Colonel Gerineldo Marquez asked him for instructions for the evacuation of a spot on the border, where there was a danger that the conflict would become an international affair. "Don't bother me with trifles," he ordered him. "Consult divine providence." It was perhaps the most critical moment of the war. The liberal landowners, who had supported the revolution in the beginning, had made secret alliances with the conservative landowners in order to stop the revision of property titles. The politicians who supplied funds for the war from exile had publicly repudiated the drastic aims of Colonel Aureliano Buendia, but even that withdrawal of authorization did not seem to bother him. He had not returned to reading his poetry, which filled more than 5 volumes and lay forgotten at the bottom of his trunk. At night, or at siesta time, he would call one of his women to his hammock and obtain a rudimentary satisfaction from her, and then he would sleep like a stone that was not concerned by the slightest indication of worry. Only he knew at that time that his confused heart was condemned to uncertainty forever. At first, intoxicated by the glory of his return, by his remarkable victories, he had peeped into the abyss of greatness. He took pleasure in keeping by his right hand the Duke of Marlborough, his great teacher in the art of war, whose attire of skins and tiger claws aroused the respect of adults and the awe of children. It was then that he decided that no human being, not even Ursula, could come closer to him than 10 feet. In the center of the chalk circle that his aides would draw wherever he stopped, and which only he could enter, he would decide with brief orders that had no appeal the fate of the world. The first time that he was in Manare after the shooting of General Moncada, he hastened to fulfill his victim's last wish, and the widow took the glasses, the medal, the watch, and the ring, but she would not let him in the door. "You can't come in, Colonel," she told him. "You may be in command of your war, but I'm in command of my house." Colonel Aureliano Buendia did not show any sign of anger, but his spirit only calmed down when his bodyguard had sacked the widow's house and reduced it to ashes. "Watch out for your heart, Aureliano," Colonel Gerineldo Marquez would say to him then. "You're rotting alive." About that time he called together a second assembly of the principal rebel commanders. He found all types, idealists, ambitious people, adventurers, those with social resentments, even common criminals. There was even a former conservative functionary who had taken refuge in the revolt to escape a judgment for misappropriation of funds. Many of them did not even know why they were fighting.
In the midst of that motley crowd, whose difference of values were on the verge of causing an internal explosion, one gloomy authority stood out, General Teófilo Vargas. He was a full-blooded Indian, untamed, illiterate, and endowed with quiet wiles and a messianic vocation that aroused a demented fanaticism in his men. Colonel Aureliano Buendía called the meeting with the aim of unifying the rebel command against the maneuvers of the politicians. General Teófilo Vargas came forward with his intentions. In a few hours, he shattered the coalition of better qualified commanders and took charge of the main command. "He's a wild beast worth watching," Colonel Aureliano Buendía told his officers. "That man is more dangerous to us than the Minister of War." Then a very young captain, who had always been outstanding for his timidity, raised a cautious index finger. "It's quite simple, Colonel," he proposed. "He has to be killed." Colonel Aureliano Buendía was not alarmed by the coldness of the proposition, but by the way in which, by a fraction of a second, it had anticipated his own thoughts. "Don't expect me to give an order like that," he said. He did not give it, as a matter of fact. But 2 weeks later, General Teófilo Vargas was cut to bits by machetes in an ambush, and Colonel Aureliano Buendía assumed the main command. The same night that his authority was recognized by all the rebel commands, he woke up in a fright, calling for a blanket. An inner coldness which shattered his bones and tortured him even in the heat of the sun would not let him sleep for several months, until it became a habit. The intoxication of power began to break apart under waves of discomfort. Searching for a cure against the chill, he had the young officer who had proposed the murder of General Teófilo Vargas shot. His orders were being carried out even before they were given, even before he thought of them, and they always went much beyond what he would have dared have them do. Lost in the solitude of his immense power, he began to lose direction. He was bothered by the people who cheered him in neighboring villages, and he imagined that they were the same cheers they gave the enemy. Everywhere he met adolescents who looked at him with his own eyes, who spoke to him with his own voice, who greeted him with the same mistrust with which he greeted them, and who said they were his sons. He felt scattered about, multiplied, and more solitary than ever. He was convinced that his own officers were lying to him. He fought with the Duke of Marlborough. "The best friend a person has," he would say at that time, "is one who has just died." He was weary of the uncertainty, of the vicious circle of that eternal war that always found him in the same place, but always older, wearier, even more in the position of not knowing why or how or even when. There was always someone outside of the chalk circle, someone who needed money, someone who had a son with whooping cough, or someone who wanted to go off and sleep forever because he could not stand the shit taste of the war in his mouth, and who, nevertheless, stood at attention to inform him, "Everything normal, Colonel." And normality was precisely the most fearful part of that infinite war. Nothing ever happened. Alone, abandoned by his premonitions, fleeing the chill that was to accompany him until death, he sought a last refuge in Macondo in the warmth of his oldest memories. His indolence was so serious that when they announced the arrival of a commission from his party that was authorized to discuss the stalemate of the war, he rolled over in his hammock without completely waking up. "Take them to the whores," he said. They were six lawyers in frock coats and top hats who endured the violent November sun with stiff stoicism. Ursula put them up in her house. They spent the greater part of the day closeted in the bedroom in hermetic conferences, and at dusk they asked for an escort and some accordion players, and took over Caterino's store. "Leave them alone," Colonel Aureliano Buendía ordered. "After all, I know what they want." At the beginning of December, the long-awaited interview, which many had foreseen as an interminable argument, was resolved in less than an hour. In the hot parlor, beside the specter of the pianola shrouded in a white sheet, Colonel Aureliano Buendía did not sit down that time inside the chalk circle that his aides had drawn. He sat in a chair between his political advisers, and, wrapped in his woolen blanket, he listened in silence to the brief proposals of the emissaries. They asked first that he renounce the revision of property titles in order to get back the support of the liberal landowners. They asked, secondly, that he renounce the fight against clerical influence in order to obtain the support of the Catholic masses. They asked, finally, that he renounce the aim of equal rights for natural and illegitimate children in order to preserve the integrity of the home. That means, Colonel Aureliano Buendia said, smiling when the reading was over, that all we're fighting for is power. They're tactical changes, one of the delegates replied. Right now the main thing is to broaden the popular base of the war. Then we'll have another look. One of Colonel Aureliano Buendia's political advisers hastened to intervene. It's a contradiction, he said. If these changes are good, it means that the conservative regime is good. If we succeed in broadening the popular base of the war with them, as you people say, it means that the regime has a broad popular base. It means, in short, that for almost 20 years, we've been fighting against the sentiments of the nation. He was going to go on, but Colonel Aureliano Buendia stopped him with a signal. Don't waste your time, Doctor, he said. The important thing is that from now on we'll be fighting only for power. Still smiling, he took the documents the delegates gave him and made ready to sign them. Since that's the way it is, he concluded, we have no objection to accepting. His men looked at one another in consternation. Excuse me, Colonel. Colonel Gerineldo Marquez said softly, but this is a betrayal. Colonel Aureliano Buendia held the inked pen in the air and discharged the whole weight of his authority on him. Surrender your weapons, he ordered. Colonel Gerineldo Marquez stood up and put his sidearms on the table. Report to the barracks, Colonel Aureliano Buendia ordered him. Put yourself at the disposition of the Revolutionary Court. Then he signed the declaration and gave the sheets of paper to the emissaries, saying to them, here are your papers, gentlemen. I hope you can get some advantage out of them. 2 days later, Colonel Gerineldo Marquez, accused of high treason, was condemned to death. Lying in his hammock, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was insensible to the pleas for clemency. On the eve of the execution, disobeying the orders not to bother him, Ursula visited him in his bedroom. Encased in black, invested with a rare solemnity, she stood during the 3 minutes of the interview. I know that you're going to shoot Gerineldo, she said calmly, and that I can't do anything to stop it. But I give you one warning. As soon as I see his body, I swear to you by the bones of my father and mother, by the memory of José Arcadio Buendía, I swear to you before God that I will drag you out from wherever you're hiding and kill you with my own 2 hands. Before leaving the room, without waiting for any reply, she concluded, it's the same as if you'd been born with the tail of a pig. During that interminable night, while Colonel Gerineldo Marquez thought about his dead afternoons in Amaranta's sewing room, Colonel Aureliano Buendia scratched for many hours, trying to break the hard shell of his solitude. His only happy moments since that remote afternoon, when his father had taken him to see ice, had taken place in his silver workshop, where he passed the time putting little gold fishes together. He had had to start 32 wars, and had had to violate all of his pacts with death, and wallow like a hog in the dung heap of glory in order to discover the privileges of simplicity, almost 40 years late. At dawn, worn out by the tormented vigil, he appeared in the cell an hour before the execution. The farce is over, old friend, he said to Colonel Gerineldo Marquez. Let's get out of here before the mosquitoes in here execute you. Colonel Gerineldo Marquez could not repress the disdain that was inspired in him by that attitude. No, Aureliano, he replied. I'd rather be dead than see you changed into a bloody tyrant. You won't see me, Colonel Aureliano Buendia said. Put on your shoes and help me get this shitty war over with. When he said it, he did not know that it was easier to start a war than to end one. It took him almost a year of fierce and bloody effort to force the government to propose conditions of peace favorable to the rebels, and another year to convince his own partisans of the convenience of accepting them.
He went to inconceivable extremes of cruelty to put down the rebellion of his own officers, who resisted and called for victory, and he finally relied on enemy forces to make them submit. He was never a greater soldier than at that time. The certainty that he was finally fighting for his own liberation, and not for abstract ideals, for slogans that politicians could twist left and right according to the circumstances, filled him with an ardent enthusiasm. Colonel Hernaldo Marquez, who fought for defeat with as much conviction and loyalty as he had previously fought for victory, reproached him for his useless temerity. "Don't worry," he would say, smiling. "Dying is much more difficult than one imagines." In his case, it was true. The certainty that his day was assigned gave him a mysterious immunity, an immortality for a fixed period that made him invulnerable to the risks of war, and in the end permitted him to win a defeat that was much more difficult, much more bloody and costly than victory. In almost 20 years of war, Colonel Aureliano Buendia had been at his house many times, but the state of urgency with which he always arrived, the military retinue that accompanied him everywhere, the aura of legend that glowed about his presence, and of which even Ursula was aware, changed him into a stranger in the end. The last time that he was in Macondo, and took a house for his 3 concubines, he was seen in his own house only on 2 or 3 occasions, when he had the time to accept an invitation to dine. Remedios the Beauty and the twins, born during the middle of the war, scarcely knew him. Amaranta could not reconcile her image of the brother who had spent his adolescence making little gold fishes with that of the mythical warrior who had placed a distance of 10 feet between himself and the rest of humanity. But when the approach of the armistice became known, and they thought that he would return changed back into a human being, delivered at last for the hearts of his own people, the family feelings, dormant for such a long time, were reborn stronger than ever. "We'll finally have a man in the house again," Ursula said. Amaranta was the first to suspect that they had lost him forever. 1 week before the armistice, when he entered the house without an escort, preceded by 2 barefoot orderlies who deposited on the porch the saddle from the mule and the trunk of poetry, all that was left of his former imperial baggage, she saw him pass by the sewing room, and she called to him. Colonel Aureliano Buendia had trouble recognizing her. "It's Amaranta," she said good-humouredly, happy at his return, and she showed him the hand with the black bandage. "Look." Colonel Aureliano Buendia smiled at her the same way as when he had first seen her with the bandage on, that remote morning when he had come back to Macondo condemned to death. "How awful," he said, "the way time passes." The regular army had to protect the house. He arrived amid insults, spat upon, accused of having accelerated the war in order to sell it for a better price. He was trembling with fever and cold, and his armpits were studded with sores again. 6 months before, when she had talked about the armistice, Ursula had opened up and swept out the bridal chamber, and had burnt myrrh in the corners, thinking that he would come back ready to grow old slowly among Remedios' musty dolls. But actually, during the last 2 years, he had paid his final dues to life, including growing old. When he passed by the silver shop, which Ursula had prepared with special diligence, he did not even notice that the keys were in the lock. He did not notice the minute, tearing destruction that time had wreaked on the house, and that, after such a prolonged absence, would have looked like a disaster to any man who had kept his memories alive. He was not pained by the peeling of the whitewash on the walls, or the dirty, cottony cobwebs in the corners, or the dust on the begonias, or the veins left on the beams by the termites, or the moss on the hinges, or any of the insidious traps that nostalgia offered him. He sat down on the porch, wrapped in his blanket, and with his boots still on, as if only waiting for it to clear, and he spent the whole afternoon watching it rain on the begonias. Ursula understood then that they would not have him home for long. "If it's not the war," she thought, "it can only be death." It was a supposition that was so neat, so convincing, that she identified it as a premonition. That night, at dinner, the supposed Aureliano Segundo broke his bread with his right hand and drank his soup with his left. His twin brother, the supposed José Arcadio Segundo, broke his bread with his left hand and drank his soup with his right. So precise was their coordination that they did not look like two brothers sitting opposite each other, but like a trick with mirrors. The spectacle that the twins had invented, when they became aware that they were equal, was repeated in honor of the new arrival. But Colonel Aureliano Buendia did not notice it. He seemed so alien to everything that he did not even notice Remedios the Beauty as she passed by naked on her way to her bedroom. Ursula was the only one who dared disturb his abstraction.
"If you have to go away again," she said halfway through dinner, "at least try to remember how we were tonight."
Then Colonel Aureliano Buendia realized, without surprise, that Ursula was the only human being who had succeeded in penetrating his misery, and for the first time in many years he looked her in the face. Her skin was leathery, her teeth decayed, her hair faded and colorless, and her look frightened. He compared her with the oldest memory that he had of her, the afternoon when he had the premonition that a pot of boiling soup was going to fall off the table, and he found her broken to pieces. In an instant he discovered the scratches, the welts, the sores, the ulcers, and the scars that had been left on her by more than half a century of daily life, and he saw that those damages did not even arouse a feeling of pity in him. Then he made one last effort to search in his heart for the place where his affection had rotted away, and he could not find it. On another occasion, he felt at least a confused sense of shame when he found the smell of Ursula on his own skin, and more than once he felt her thoughts interfering with his. But all of that had been wiped out by the war. Even Remedios, his wife, at that moment was a hazy image of someone who might have been his daughter. The countless women he had known on the desert of love, and who had spread his seed all along the coast, had left no trace in his feelings. Most of them had come into his room in the dark and had left before dawn, and on the following day there were nothing but a touch of fatigue in his bodily memory. The only affection that prevailed against time and the war was that which he had felt for his brother José Arcadio, when they both were children, and it was not based on love, but on complicity. "I'm sorry," he excused himself from Ursula's request. "It's just that the war has done away with everything." During the following days he busied himself destroying all trace of his passage through the world. He stripped the silver shop until all that were left were impersonal objects. He gave his clothes away to the orderlies, and he buried his weapons in the courtyard with the same feeling of penance with which his father had buried the spear that had killed Prudencio Aguilar. He kept only one pistol, with one bullet in it. Ursula did not intervene. The only time she dissuaded him was when he was about to destroy the daguerreotype of Remedios that was kept in the parlor, lighted by an eternal lamp. "That picture stopped belonging to you a long time ago," she told him. "It's a family relic." On the eve of the armistice, when no single object that would let him be remembered was left in the house, he took the trunk of poetry to the bakery, when Santa Sofia de la Piedad was making ready to light the oven. "Light it with this," he told her, handing her the first roll of yellowish papers. "It will burn better because they're very old things." Santa Sofia de la Piedad, the silent one, the condescending one, the one who never contradicted anyone, not even her own children, had the impression that it was a forbidden act.
"They're important papers," she said.
"Nothing of the sort," the colonel said. "They're things that a person writes to himself."
"In that case," she said, "you burn them, colonel."
He not only did that, but he broke up the trunk with a hatchet and threw the pieces into the fire. Hours before, Pilar Tenera had come to visit him. After so many years of not seeing her, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was startled at how old and fat she had become, and how much she had lost of the splendor of her laugh. But he was also startled at the depths she had reached in her reading of the cards. "Watch out for your mouth," she told him, and he wondered whether the other time she had told him that, during the height of his glory, it had not been a surprisingly anticipated vision of his fate. A short time later, when his personal physician finished removing his sores, he asked him, without showing any particular interest, where the exact location of his heart was. The doctor listened with his stethoscope,
and then painted a circle on his chest with a piece of cotton dipped in iodine. The Tuesday of the armistice dawned warm and rainy. Colonel Aureliano Buendia appeared in the kitchen before 5 o'clock, and had his usual black coffee without sugar. "You came into the world on a day like this," Ursula told him. "Everybody was amazed at your